Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
There's the Indo-Pacific framework. There are negotiations with the EU on a variety of SBS issues. There's the issue involving Canada and trying to make sure that they live up to the USMCA with dairy. There's the issue in Mexico in terms of the ability to assure that biotech corn can be used. There are tariff reductions in Vietnam that resulted in more pork sales. There are additional issues in Central American countries where we have created additional opportunities.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack telling senators the U.S. is active on the ag trade front.
There's a whole variety of things going on in the trade front that don't necessarily require free trade agreements, but they do require breaking down barriers. They do require restoring trust. They do require saying when we have a trade agreement, we're going to enforce it. And that's precisely what we're doing with USMCA.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Last time you were before the committee, as you may remember, New Mexico was facing some really large fires, the largest in our state's history.
At a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing, New Mexico Senator Ben Ray Lujan talking to Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
And I just want to say I appreciate your support and your help to keep in mind the families of New Mexico and the challenges that those families are facing. So thank you for that. As you would suspect, not all families have received all the support that I hope that we'll be able to work together to ensure that they benefit from. But the way that the teams are working now and the attention, I just want to recognize that. Now, Secretary Vilsack, the questions that I have are surrounding that fire. And the first one I have is, when the federal government is responsible for a disaster, like they were in this case, such as this wildfire, does the federal government have the responsibility to support the recovery?
Absolutely.
And can I count on your support to ensure that everyone in your department knows that getting New Mexico the resources needed to meet the needs of residents is a priority of the administration?
Yes. In fact, Senator, we worked with your governor to establish a opportunity for there to be a meeting where we had multiple agencies and missionaries from USDA present that would allow an easy time for folks to fill out the applications and to figure out what potential benefits there might be and help there might be. So we continue to look for ways in which we can be helpful.
And speaking of being helpful, another issue the West is dealing with, drought. Colorado Senator Michael Bennett.
It won't surprise you to know that I'm going to start with drought, our 1,200-year drought in the Rocky Mountain West. We reintroduced our bill to protect our watersheds and do what needs to be done with our national forests, the Protect the West Act this week. But I was very pleased that we were able to work together to include $10 billion in the when you combine the money in the infrastructure bill and in the Inflation Reduction Act for pre-fire mitigation, for forest health, for all of that. That's a big chunk of money. It's an unprecedented amount of money. It's a lot less than the $60 billion that we've spent the last 5 years fighting fires in the West. But as you know, and I know you know this, it's a much cheaper way of dealing with the issue that we're confronting. I wonder if you could just give the committee an update about how you guys are thinking about spending that money, getting it on the landscape, and making sure we make the most of what Congress has appropriated.
The first thing that we needed to do, Senator, was to identify where the most significant fire shed risk was in the West, and we have identified that in 21 priority landscapes, 250 fire sheds within those landscapes, roughly 45 million acres all told. We are in the process of investing nearly $1 billion over the next couple of years in those in 134 of those 250 fire sheds in an effort to try to mitigate and reduce the risk of catastrophic fire, which is a serious issue. So there is resource being spent there. There's also resource being spent in helping communities become more resilient to fire, fire adaptive communities. That is also part of what we're doing. And finally, we're working to reforest. We have a fairly significant and pretty aggressive goal of doing hundreds of thousands of more acres of reforestation, and that project is also being funded because of what you all did on the Replant Act.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Number one, we're going to breeding season. I mean, that's what the pasture is for spring calving cows. And so we need to protect those cows against the major reproductive infectious diseases. And so we want to protect them against IBR, the two BVDs, lepto, and then the V on our vaccine stands for Vibrio. It's actually a new name called Campylobacter, but those are the four organisms that we actually want to protect those cows from during that breeding season to maximize our efficiency there.
Talking about spring-bred cows, Greg Hanselcheck, Kansas State veterinarian, on the timing.
We've always said in the past that we want those vaccines to go in those cows, and it can be killed or modified live, 30 to 45 days before bull turnout or before we AI them, because we need to give them enough time to respond. And there are some mild and transitory negative impacts of especially modified live on the fertility. But some of the latest information from some of our bovine immunologists suggest that it shouldn't be 30 to 45 days. It should be 45 to 60 days before the breeding season. So that just means we have to start a little bit earlier in the spring before we go to pasture.
Hanselcheck also reminds us to remember the bulls.
I really think that sometimes we forget about the bulls, whether it's deworming or fly control or vaccinations, but it is important to protect them against these same diseases. And so easy recommendation is to just treat the bulls like you do the cows. Use the same vaccine, use the same vaccination schedule, and that helps protect them. And everybody knows you have a bull that goes bad or becomes infertile or whatever due to a disease, the impact on the herd is a lot more than one cow that becomes infertile. And so, yeah, we need to make sure those bulls are getting the right vaccination program.
He also talks about the importance of breeding soundness exams.
We're not going to identify bulls that are sterile. What we're trying to do is identify those bulls that are less fertile and to get them out of the herd before the breeding season. So it has a lot of limitations. All we can do is look at the sperm particularly and some of the anatomy of the bull. What it won't assess is the libido of the bull and the bull's ability to actually do the breeding. And so we recommend do the breeding soundness exam, and then when the producer's out in the pasture checking calves and cows for health, make sure you're watching the bulls, make sure that they have the desire to breed and the fact that they can anatomically also breed, because we have several cases of that every year.
And what about those first calf heifers? Hanselcheck says,
the baseline, most people would say, let's give them the Clostridium 7-way to protect them against some of the purple gut, the overeating, and those kind of things. If herds that have had problems with, unfortunately, a more common and relatively new health issue called pasture pneumonia or pre-breeding pneumonia, those herds are probably going to need to do something different as far as vaccination for those calves. We don't have that disease figured out. So to say that there's a baseline or a blanket vaccination program is wrong, just recommend that they work with their veterinarian and say, hey, we have this problem when we go to pasture or later in the pasture season, what can we do vaccination-wise to prevent it?
Yeah, respiratory concern should be considered here then.
And it is a respiratory disease, so whether they add the manhymias and the pastorellas and some of those respiratory organisms, that's between them and the veterinarian.
With tips for this spring breeding season, Greg Hanselcheck, Kansas State veterinarian. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The important thing to remember is that, you know, atypical BSE is something that does occur naturally. The United States has had cases of atypical BSE as well.
Just the talk of BSE, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, can cause concern, especially among consumers. Kent Backus is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
None of those animals ever ended up in the food supply, but as part of the World Organization for Animal Health, we notified all of our trade partners within 24 hours of the incident occurring. Now, atypical BSE is not a trade-restrictive disease. It's not like classical BSE, where you really have to worry about ruminant-to-ruminant feed ban violations and other things like that. But it is still a disease that we're supposed to report. We're also supposed to report diseases like foot and mouth disease, African swine fever, and other devastating diseases like that. That's to give countries the opportunity to take action to defend, their supply chains if necessary. But Brazil, unlike the United States and many other countries, continues to delay reporting. Now, again, we're supposed to report these cases within 24 hours, but Brazil has taken many times it's taken, several days or weeks, even months. And in one case, it took almost 2 years to report these cases. So we've been very consistent in our request with USDA to suspend their access until a thorough investigation and audit can be conducted.
And that's why the cattle industry concerned with Brazil today. But what is NCBA doing?
One of the things that NCBA does is we continue to monitor these events as they occur all over the world, and we pay particular close attention to what's happening in Brazil. We were the first ones to raise the two atypical BSE cases when they occurred in 2021. We were also the first ones to raise concerns about this most recent incident of atypical BSE that took 35 days to report. So we put that together along with examples of all of the other atypical BSE cases that Brazil has had, along with a comparison to incidents that had happened in other places, and put all of that scientific information into a letter, sent that to Secretary Vilsack with a simple request: suspend these guys until we can actually go through and verify that what they are doing and how they're raising their cattle provide an equivalent level of safety to what we're doing here. That's all we're asking for. But it was NCBA was the first out to do that. We're going to continue to raise this issue. We believe in science-based trade, but we also believe in accountability. And that's one thing that we really have to be consistent on, is if someone's going to do business here, then they better live up to our standards and they better take all the same precautions that we do.
Because at the end of the day, there's concern about demand for beef. Caitlin McCulloch, Director, Livestock Marketing Information Center.
This demand picture is one of the things we're trying our best to wrap our arms around and to see if we can see any changes. And so we check out things like more anecdotally sometimes to just see what's being featured. Pork is going to start being featured fairly heavily, especially now that the price differential looks like it's going to get a little bit wider. Does that mean we see less beef move on the grocery store front? Hard to say, but that's one of the things we're watching. The other thing I would say, we're watching the negotiated cattle price. That's held 164.5 last week. Very, very good price. And if we start to see that come down in an environment where we have less and less cattle on feed, that might be an indication that there's a little bit of a demand problem here in the U.S., or maybe not a problem, that might be a mischaracterization, a little bit of demand slowing, let's say that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
About a year ago, we sent a letter to the GEO with our farmers' concerns. These are not my concerns. These are my farmers' concerns about the way the USDA has been using the CCC.
Recent Senate Ag Committee oversight hearing of USDA, where Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack being questioned by Kansas Senator Roger Marshall.
Well, I'm still waiting on the response. I'm worried that the farm bill negotiations will be hindered, especially if you believe that the USDA can use the CCC for programs that we ultimately decide not to include in the farm bill. How can we be confident in negotiating in good faith if USDA continues to create programs without congressional approval under CCC discretionary fund use?
Well, to be clear, Senator, we don't create programs without making sure that they fall within the direction that Congress has provided in creating the CCC. For example, when we did the partnership initiative, it is focused on creating market opportunities, which is clearly within the purview of the CCC as established by Congress. So we're not working outside the bounds of what you all have created and directed CCC to do. And I'll tell you, it is a incredibly wonderful tool to respond to things like a need for fertilizer, the need for us to expand production of fertilizer here in the U.S. CCC is giving us the opportunity to create resources that will allow us to be more self-reliant on fertilizer and hopefully over time reduce the cost of that to producers. So we're very careful to stay with, well, there are two issues here. We're very careful to stay within the statutory language that authorizes the CCC expenditures, and we never, ever, ever put at risk the farm bill programs that require CCC funding.
Our farmers and ranchers feel like how you're using the CCC is outside of the law. And I think that we need to be able to better understand that.
Senator, with all due respect, when we did the Partnership for Climate Smart Agriculture initiative, we had the Farmer and Rancher and the Food Alliance, which was made up of the major commodity groups, Farm Bureau, National Farmers Union, corn growers, soybean growers. In fact, they are participating as participants in this effort. Say to us two things. One, Mr. Secretary, do this. Do it in a voluntary, incentive-based, market-based way. And two, Mr. Secretary, fund it through the CCC. These are the major farm organizations telling us how to fund this.
And on trade?
What concrete steps have you taken or do you intend to take to convince the administration to open up new markets for American agriculture, especially when your department is predicting a record agriculture trade deficit?
Well, to be clear, the last 2 years we've had record exports in agriculture. And I think it's important for
because of commodity prices, but go ahead.
Well, nevertheless, they're records.
Yeah.
The challenge, I think, is to build trust in this country in trade. Agriculture farmers understand the importance of trade because of historic surpluses. They understand it. They appreciate it. But that's not true of all industries and not all parts of the country. There are folks who believe the trade is not.
So do you have any concrete steps that you can let us know what's happening on the trade side of agriculture?
Sure. There's the Indo-Pacific framework. There are negotiations with the EU on a variety of SBS issues. There's the issue involving Canada and trying to make sure that they live up to the USMCA with dairy. There's the issue in Mexico in terms of the ability to assure that biotech corn can be used. There are tariff reductions in Vietnam that resulted in more pork sales. There are additional issues in Central American countries where we have created additional opportunities. There's a whole variety of things going on in the trade front that don't necessarily require free trade agreements, but they do require breaking down barriers. They do require restoring trust. They do require saying when we have a trade agreement, we're going to enforce it. And that's precisely what we're doing with USMCA.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The density of the mineral as far as the minerals and especially the vitamins doesn't really need to be that high because the grass is going to take care of it.
Kansas State veterinarian Greg Hanselcheck on mineral supplementation.
And I'm talking primarily vitamin A and vitamin E. So to save some dollars, a lot of us would just say, let's put the minimum amount of A and E in the mineral because the grass is going to have more and ample enough. Now we have to make sure that the mineral has enough copper and zinc because those two trace minerals are very important for the integrity of the skin and the eyes. And so those are important to help prevent foot rot and pink eye. But as far as the vitamins, put those at a minimum. And then as we get into the later stages of the pasture where they start turning brown, that tells us that the vitamin E and the vitamin A is actually not there anymore. That's the time to bring back a more dense mineral. And so it's a cost savings thing. And then the cows really don't need a fancy or a high-dollar mineral during the early pasture season.
Hanselcheck addresses fly control.
Insect growth regulators and larvicides by themselves, they're very, very helpful, but we're going to need, you know, the ill fly tags. It's still probably the best bang for your buck. There's some really good guidelines out there that if we're going to use those products, which we recommend people do, that we tag the cows. Research has shown two tags are much, much more effective than one. And I recommend don't forget the bulls. If it's safe and you can catch a bull, I'd put a couple of ear tags in those bulls too because they carry an awful lot of flies. And then the recommendation is if we've got pastures where we have a major fly problem, we've got pink eye on our calves, it may be necessary to tag them. But for most of us, we're going to start with the cows. We know we're building resistance in flies because we're using the same products year after year. And what happens, it kills the flies that are susceptible to those products. But the ones that aren't susceptible, they're the ones that are breeding. And so in time, our fly control becomes very inefficient. And so, yeah, if there's a couple rotations out there, if a herd's using just the pyrethroids and the organophosphates, we recommend they go pyrethroid, 2 years in a row. then go to an organophosphate, and then go back to 2 years of pyrethroids. If they're using a free chemical rotation, then they'd go organophosphate, pyrethroid, and then avermectins the third year. The point is just keep those products rotating so that we're not building resistance.
And then there's the issue of dewormers.
It's really important that we do something, and what we're trying to do is protect the calves from ingesting enough internal parasites that it affects their performance. In the past, we just concentrated on, you know, every cow as they go to pasture, we're going to deworm them. Our dewormers only last about 14 to 30 days, and so it's short-lived. There's some longer-acting injectables that'll go up to 100-plus days. But the point is that because we're seeing so much resistance with our ivermectins with internal parasites, it's recommended that we do not deworm all the cows as we go to pasture. There's a term called refugia, and to have refugia in our herd, then that recommendation is just deworm those that are under 5 years of age. Those cows that are over five, they have an immunity to the worms. They're not going to carry a heavy burden, and the worms they're producing will remain susceptible to the products we're using, and so we're not building resistance. That's another great thing to do is that, yeah, because we have so much resistance to our ivermectins out there, that the best bang for your buck would be to use two different classes of dewormer.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This number is going to be interesting.
Bob Mowers with Manduka Trading in Chicago as we look towards USDA's planting intentions number.
The data that we got from the USDA are basically their belief of where we're at right now. And their latest basically said, if I take them one by one, that planted acreage for all, which should be about 49.5 million acres versus the still to be hard number of 45.7. So basically looking at higher acreage for wheat and a bit higher yield for wheats, and production number therefore is going to be higher. Exports on the other hand are also expected to be higher by about 50 million, and the ending stocks ending up somewhere around 608 versus 568. Ish this year. That's an estimate at the moment. So roughly about a 40 million bale gain year on year in terms of ending stocks. So higher numbers pretty much across the board there for wheat. In terms of soybeans, they're looking for the same as last year, about 87.5-ish. You know, these numbers can change a little bit, but 87.5 yield is 52. That's 2.5 bushel per acre improvement compared to the previous year, and about a 0.8 bushel improvement from 21-22. Exports expected to be 2,025,000,000 versus 1.99 billion the previous year, or this year that we're in right now. So improvement there in terms of exports, and ending stocks numbers also popping up a little bit. So steady in terms of planted acreage number, but with a higher yield that makes higher production. Export sales didn't offset that whole production. We're looking at higher ending stocks for soybeans. In terms of corn, looking at about 91 million acres. Yield is also higher by about 8 bushels per acre, which is big. Prediction number 15.085. So that's higher than this year's estimate so far, about 13.7. Exports are also expected to increase. Ending stocks, therefore, are expected to increase because the increase in exports doesn't offset the increase in production. So we're looking for higher ending stocks rather significantly. And just to give a little bit of context there, back in 21-22, ending stocks was shy of 1.4 billion, and we're looking at almost 1.9 billion if the USDA's numbers is correct. And if we shift our focus over to the the big three, shall we say, so I take all that data I just gave you for corn, wheat, and soybeans, and add them all together, and they're looking for total acreage this year of 228 million acres compared to 200 and just shy of 222 in 2022. So this would be one of the biggest numbers we've seen, and actually came close in 2021 with the 227.2 number, and not too far in 2016 with the 227.6. So bigger numbers to work with just in terms of crops in the ground and the acreage number. And if Mother Nature is conducive, you could see that could put some pressure in these markets. If you look at cotton in specific, similar story, you're looking at, the USDA projection of about 10.9 million acres. That's 21% below 22's 13.8 million acres and the lowest we've seen since 2016. So a lot of movement in the numbers year on year for sure, based on just what happened with the crops there, but also, you know, in terms of the context of the last 3 to 5 years. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how this all comes together.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're increasing staffing, but two things. One is our compensation structure and system is no longer as competitive as it once was.
Despite hiring more, staffing problems continue, says Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
It used to be that job was maybe the best job in the county. That's not the case today. And so we have significant competition. We get loan officers in FSA. We train them. And then the bank comes in and says, hey, we can pay you more with a whole lot less stress. And then secondly, you know, it's tough to work for the government these days. It's tough. People feel put upon in terms of the criticism that is often the case with public service. So I think we need to be very careful about making sure that we're bolstering public service, we're supporting public service, so that we can continue to get enough people willing to do the jobs that are important to be done.